And as Jim had alluded to, many of our friends in the Dirt Zendo are just wrapping up retreat. And so I imagine it's pretty sparse. Like you guys look like the Zendo itself looks like it's pretty, and like there's not a lot of stuff there. But yeah, so I'm gonna do my best to, oof, I think it said in the newsletter that I was gonna give a talk. I don't know if I would call it a talk. Hopefully we can just kind of talk about some things. Generally, you know, I'm just gonna talk a little bit about I don't know, my experiences in practice, and then maybe some of that will like resonate with some of you, and we can talk about some things. But yeah, the way I usually do these is I carry around a little notebook, and as I go, I just kind of write thoughts that I have down in the notebook, and then I try to coalesce them into some sort of meaningful theme. And I don't know how well I did with finding a theme, so this is just going to be maybe like a patchwork of thoughts. But the best I could come up with, and this is a practice, this is a question I think that I've been struggling a lot with, like even like probably ever since I started my own practice.
I'm switching to speaker view.
Oh, excellent. Okay, great. All right. So everything kind of coalesced into this interesting theme that honestly I think has been running through my practice since the very beginning. The best question that I can come with that maybe unifies all of my thoughts is like, how do you do Zen? And so for whatever we want to think about, and as you're listening, like I want you to maybe prompt yourself to just think about like, what do you do for Zen? And so I came up with this question, and I think this is a question that I've been asking myself a lot, and often in like a negative light. I'm in North Carolina. I'm on the East Coast. It's 2 in the afternoon here, and I've actually been to the Dirt Zendo, but most of my practice is here in my house in like this like sunroom. And so for me, and I think for all of us, we all came to Zen. I don't think any of us, well, I think Alice was raised in a Buddhist household. For a lot of us, we like sought this out. And so after a while of seeking it out, I kind of had this question of like, well, like, am I a Buddhist now? Like, is now different than what I was doing a week ago or a month ago or a year ago? What do I have to do for it to be different enough to say, like, now I am a Zen Buddhist and before I was not? And that was a really difficult question, especially for me, because I didn't go anywhere. I didn't like, you know, people go to church and they're Christians, they go to church and they pray. And I like sat in a room, right? And I got on Zoom meetings. And so I really struggled a lot with like, am I doing it? Am I doing it right? What should I be doing? And so a lot of the questions that I saw, a lot of the thoughts that I wrote down as I was thinking about what I would say today kind of fell into that theme. And I don't know if I'll be able to answer a lot of these questions, but I do have sort of I guess my take on it. And I'll tell you that I think about things like this generally in this way, and maybe some of you do as well, but I always think like, oh, in the future it'll be much clearer if I just get this, if I just have this, if I just do this thing, then I will feel comfortable. I'll feel like, yeah, I am doing it. I am being Zen. And for me, a big part of that was Jukai. I was like, man, I'm gonna go to the ceremony. I'm gonna get my Wagesa, and that's, and then I will know it. I will know it in my bones. And you know, it didn't answer a lot of those questions. You know, it took maybe like a week or two, and then I was like, wait, am I doing it? Now I'm sitting with this thing on, but is this? And so, like, struggling with this question, I think is a regular part of practice. I would imagine that all of us fall somewhere on here of trying to figure out, like, what do I do? What do I do to do Zen? And am I doing that thing? So I'm actually going to, like, usually, like, when I've given these talks in the past, I kind of, like, it's this sort of subtle way of discounting myself. I just kind of do a book report and I tell you, like, what Rev Anderson thinks, and then what Shinru Suzuki thinks, and then what maybe Dogen said about it. And I don't really answer it. I just kind of throw a bunch of stuff up in the air and say, well, you figure it out. But this time I challenged myself to actually give you an answer. It's just my best thought at it. What I have really found helpful that I do in my own practice is I kind of sit and think about things like this. And my answers are sort of this, are sort of constantly evolving. And what today is just sort of a snapshot of what I think is doing Zen for right now. And I was really proud of myself when I did this because like I'm a little nervous about it. But it's really funny. So one of Domyo's teachers, Kyogen, has this phrase that Domyo's mentioned a lot, and it's called like a particular slice of the Dharma tomato. You can slice it many ways, and each slice has its own sort of like ways of viewing it. And so I'm going to give you my little slice of the Dharma tomato, and mine is going to break how you do Zen into two things. And I found that at least what I came up with was action and understanding. And I was so proud of myself. I was like, that's great. I found two categories. This is almost like an answer. And then, of course, like, it took me a minute, but then I realized those are like two prongs of the eightfold path. That oh, I got balloons. It's my gesture. But those are two prongs of the eightfold path. So maybe I've reinvented the wheel. I've reinvented something that actually was already there. But I kind of like to think about doing Zen in terms of these two things: action and understanding. So let's talk about those. And what I want to do before we really get into talking about those things specifically, I want to talk about something. Again, this is mostly like to make it genuine. I don't think that I'm some sort of like central figure in Zen or anything. Just to make it genuine, I talk a lot about my own practice. And one of the things that I've really struggled to come to terms with is I am uncomfortable with the notion of becoming enlightened as this thing that I'm supposed to attain. Or if I'm on the path, I wouldn't say that I want to become a Buddha, which is like a strange disconnect almost in practice. Because in Zen practice, we don't gain anything. We don't have goals. We don't do that stuff. But at the same time, if you're on the path, isn't that because you want to become a Buddha? Like, isn't that because you want to become enlightened? And really, like, one of the things I would suggest reckoning with yourself, and this is a difficult thing, is come to terms with the fact that, like, you are on the path. You are a bodhisattva, and you are on the path to becoming a Buddha. And I was reading a book recently by Rev Anderson, and he's actually got a whole paragraph at it. And I want to read that. So this is from his book. He's got a book, Entering the Mind of Buddha. And he says this about sensing a wish for Buddhahood. In a sense, this whole story from seed to fruit describes an aspirational process. Many people wish to help others, but they have not yet discovered the aspiration to realize Buddhahood for that purpose. If we look into our hearts and minds and discover the aspiration to help beings, and we take care of that wish, it may eventually grow into the aspiration to realize Buddhahood. Is there a wish for the welfare of beings in your heart? Do you sense a wish for Buddhahood? As we continue on our path, we will awaken to the reality that our entire life and practice is not something that we do alone. We understand that our practice is a gift to us from all beings and a gift that we give to all beings. This is the ultimate truth of our life. Perfect wisdom is the thorough understanding of this generosity, a state wherein we meet the Buddha teaching. We meet the Buddha teaching the Dharma face to face. I always found it a little bit like that to have some wish for Buddhahood was to latch on to this sense of ego identity. I want this thing, and that thing is to become enlightened. And that's not something I wished for in practice. I genuinely don't want it for me. My genuine like feeling in practice is for the welfare of other people, for living beings. And in turn, that living beings reflects back to me. I am a living being. And I think that if you ask yourself the question, who is it that attains enlightenment? Who is it that attains Buddhahood? I don't know what that answer is. Because it's not just me. I think I understand that about attaining Buddhahood enough, is that it's not me that gets this thing. I think the answer is to genuinely live for the welfare of other beings, is to attain that thing. And so, like, a lot of my talk is about reading older texts and how to make sense of that in our lives today. I think that's the biggest shift, because in a lot of older texts, they'll talk about, you know, the path to awakening, becoming awakened, and understanding what that goal means for you, I think is an important thing to think about and to reckon with. So on to my slice of the Dharma tomato, which we're going to try to split into two things, into action and into understanding. And the way that I looked at this, the way that I tried to understand a lot of these things was to look at practices from like a very long time ago. A lot of our texts are old, you know, they're written by Dogen, they're written by Sekito Kisen. There are these very old texts that talk a lot about maybe Chinese or Japanese culture, and they're really hard to decipher, and they're especially hard to figure out what they mean for me today, like goes to work in a car. And so really what I want to try to do in this is to reconcile what I see in those old texts and how that works for us today in terms of action. And the very consistent action that happens throughout the history of Buddhism from the very beginning all the way to Domino is this notion of renunciation. If you wanted to attain the way, if you wanted to become a follower, like a true follower of Zen, for thousands of years, what that meant was you would leave your home and you would go to a monastery. You would follow a group of traveling monks in the forest. They were originally called home leavers, and you would leave the world behind and you would start this life as a monastic, a renunciate. You would sort of like cut out all of the pleasures of modern living that they were at the time, and you would practice. That's not really feasible for us who come to Zen from all places in life, but also the modern world itself is really not conducive to that. And so what I want to think about is like, how can we understand this renunciation, this action of renunciation in our own lives, where we have jobs and we pay taxes and we have kids and we got to go to college and, you know, we got to do all these things. What is it to renounce here and now? I think the most obvious thing that we do that might be helpful to think of this in terms of renunciation is zazen. We set aside a period of time, maybe it's 30 minutes, maybe it's 10 minutes, and we sit. And during that time, we renounce the way that we think. We renounce thinking of gain. We renounce our sort of normal mode of operation where promotions are important, you know, income is important, our kids getting good grades are important, making sure that we can provide for our community. All of these things are important. But when we sit zazen, not only do we sit, but we are renouncing that way of thinking for a period of time, as much as feasible for us. And that's how we practice renunciation in our world and in our lives. It's not feasible for us to leave our families and to leave our communities and to go live in a monastery or to follow a monk, but we can and do actively practice renunciation. And in a lot of ways, it's much more difficult to do it this way. It's really interesting. There is a poem by Sekito Kisen. And it's called the Grass Hut. And it's the Song of the Grass Hut. And he essentially, the idea behind the Song of the Grass Hut is that he lives in a monastery, but that's not even enough for our character. He's going to go live in a hermitage that has a grass roof like next to it. He's just, everything is gone behind. He has nothing except for this like hut that he has built with a grass roof. And to read that, right, to read that and to think that's not possible for me to do. What could I possibly learn from that? I think a really helpful practice for me has been to consistently think about the things that I do for practice as renunciation. I'm letting go of this way of thinking. I'm letting go of my busy life. I'm letting go of all of these things, and I'm just going to sit. One of the other things that I think about a lot, especially now, we're in precept season, which is like one of my favorites, are the precepts themselves. And I think, especially in terms of action, right? We have this action of renunciation. And we have this action of precepts, this sort of way of engaging in our world. And if we think about precepts in terms of guiding our actions, the precepts are some of the oldest things, sort of like surviving teachings that we have directly in Buddhism. The first five precepts were laid out by the Buddha himself and practiced since that time. And then Dogen assembled our 16 Bodhisattva precepts in the 14th century. So these are very old things. And to sort of like understand how they guide us today, I think is some of the true teachings of the Buddha. And they're really important. But if you think about the precepts sort of as an overarching theme, they're all about refraining from activity, right? So all of the precepts begin with not or non, right? You take up the way of non-killing, of non-stealing, of non-lying, non-misusing sexual energy. All of the precepts are sort of about refraining from action. And in that way, we take our regular daily lives and we renounce certain things. Certain behaviors that are habitual, that are instilled in us through ages and ages and ages of sort of like karmic understanding, right? I view the world in a particular way because I was a product of a society in a very particular time and place. You know, I learned most things from my parents. I learned from TV. I learned from movies. I learned from culture. And all of these things sort of collectively form this like big Gordian knot of karma. And they push me into actions almost unthinkingly. And I have these responses and to pause and to refrain, right? to renounce those actions, even moment to moment, as we live our lives, is a really important part of practice. And it's one of the ways that we can take the precepts, which is a very, very old teaching, and we can try to live our lives through that, like right now. So my list of doing Zen, my actions list, we've got Zazen on it, which is fairly obvious, but almost like Zazen as renunciation, right? Because I'm trying to find these themes in teachings that have been around for a very long time. And we see Zazen in it, we see renunciation in it. And then we also see the precepts almost as renunciation itself again. And then there's this interesting transition piece that's almost going to transition us from action to understanding. And it's this, like, when I first started studying precepts, there was this very, very interesting verse that caught my attention that almost stuck out to me. And I want to read it for you because, you know, a lot of times in Zen, we talk about, like, in this moment, living your life from moment to moment. You know, we try to let go of our past actions. We try to embrace right here and now without trying to control it. But there's this really interesting part at the beginning of the Kyoji Kaimon that's called the Gateway of Contrition. And you talk about contrition, and I'll read this last part. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. A contrite heart is open to the Dharma and finds the gateway to the precepts clear and unobstructed. Bearing this in mind, we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and make this act of contrition wholeheartedly. And I thought that was really interesting because contrition and atonement, it's very similar to the Gatha of Atonement that we chant on Sundays as well, seems like almost like a very separate concept from living from in this moment. How did the precepts guide me here? How can I be contrite? How can I atone for my karma? How does that work? What do I do to do that? And this is a lot of what I see when I try to look back and read some books. They're very, very difficult because I don't understand what they're telling me to do. Like, can you just give me like a list of things? That's why I love the precepts. It's just like a list of things. Like, okay, I can wrap my head around this. But like, this is a common barrier for me when I try to go out and practice Zen, is I understand that contrition is important. I understand that I need to take this step wholeheartedly, but like, what do I do? How do I make a contrite heart? How do I atone for my past karma? And I think the answer is, maybe it's obvious to other people, it's almost simpler than it might seem. I almost expect things to be complicated or difficult or like a puzzle. But really, for me, the key to atonement is sitting upright, understanding my past actions through my own karmic fingerprint. The way that I see the world, the way that I've been taught the world, is to let go of this notion of like, I'm a good person, I've done good things, I'm a bad person, I've done bad things, you know, I've done good things and bad things, these are my past, this is my past. But to be contrite, to atone for those things, that sort of karmic behavior is to sit and to open-handedly accept it and leave it, right? Because this moment is about letting go of our karmic past, and atonement and contrition is about truly sitting upright and open-handedly accepting the person that you were. And so that's a little bit of both. I think that's going to kind of transition us from action into understanding, because I think understanding is a really important part about modern practice, about practicing in your daily life now. But the really tricky part is, how do you, what are you supposed to understand? How are you supposed to gain any kind of understanding? And I think the first step of that is understanding your life, understanding the way that your reality manifests moment to moment in Zazen, understanding how your past has brought you to where you are, and just taking that open-handedly. And that will help you to sort of understand some of the teachings. There is a volume, actually an impressively large volume of sort of modern Zen texts written by modern Zen teachers. They're wonderful and great. I have a part of my karmic past as being an intellectual snob. And so I like to read a lot of like older texts. You might call them like primary sources, but I like to read Dogen. I like to read Hong Zhu. I like to read Sekito Kisen. I like to read these things. That surely, if these texts are important enough to have been kept for hundreds, if not thousands of years, there's got to be something in there. And so the idea is like, how do we understand that? There was a really interesting passage in Dogen's Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey, his Zui Monkey, and it's some of the more clear, straightforward writing that Dogen's ever done. But this passage really tripped me up. So he's talking, this book is just entirely like Dharma talks that Dogen gave during his life. And a lot of times the assemblies were like very, very small, like single digits of people. And I always really enjoy that about reading this book, because I imagine that this is just this intimate meeting of Dogen and a few other people. And, you know, Ajo's in the corner and he's writing all this stuff down, and there's not a lot of people. It's not a big following that he has. But anyways, he's talking to his students and he says this. He says, the four occupations of farming, commerce, military service, and craftsmanship all result in food of impure, wrong livelihood. And so he's saying, like, if you have one of these four occupations, one of them being commerce, if you are a farmer, if you work in commerce, military service, and craftsmanship, which in the modern era pretty much comprises like everybody's livelihood, like you're living life wrong. And one of the issues about these sort of older texts is they're full of stuff like that. They're full of stuff like, nope, it's not gonna happen for you. And so like one of the things that I think is really important is figuring out, how do I take this stuff? What's the knowledge to be gained from it? Somebody thought this is an important enough text to hold on to since the 14th century. This is an old thing. And I don't know what to discard as like just silly. And so how do you gain some understanding about your life and your world through these very, very old texts? It can be really confusing. And the advice that I have for that is that you can't do it by yourself. There's this really interesting, the passage that I read from Reb Anderson has this beautiful sort of part at the end, and I'll read it again. As we continue on our path, we will awaken to the reality that our entire life and practice is not something that we do alone. We understand that our practice is a gift to us from all beings, and a gift that we give to all beings. And I'll tell you that when I first started at Brightway, when I really started my Zen practice, there's not this sort of like clear delineation of like, I wasn't Zen then, and now I am Zen. But I came through it like I imagine many of us in the cloud did. I came through it through the podcast, heard Domio's podcast, listened to it. And there was a certain podcast episode where almost like a light went off in my mind, and I was like, well, this is it. this is really it. I'm gonna do it. So I think you still have to email for the password, but I would like email Domi. I was so nervous, and I like emailed her for like, oh, what's the password? And I thought I would like have to maybe like answer some questions before she gave me the password or something. And I came, and that first phase of practice, I was so excited to hear what Domino had to say, to watch her interact with students, to be able to interact with her, to ask questions, to kind of like just be there. And I was so wowed by it. I was like, this is Domino, this is her from the podcast. And one of the things that I never considered when I started here at Brightway was that I was joining like a community of people, a community of real, generous, kind, and knowledgeable people. I was sort of so focused on my teacher, and I was like, Domio is a teacher and she's great, and I hear on the podcast. And I really almost didn't understand that I would learn and grow alongside this community of people who were compassionate and knowledgeable and had a really deep understanding of what it is to do Zen, like how to do it. And so we have a lineage of teachers. We have teachings that have been passed down, right? We chant this on Sundays from teacher to student, face to face. We chant the names of real living people all the way from before Dogen, from all the way to the Buddha himself, all the way to Domyo's teachers. Like we have, the teachings come from there. And so if you really want this book translated into modern times, that's the whole practice of Zen. That is what Domyo is. She is a flesh and blood transmission of teachings from the time of the Buddha. And it's not just sort of like limited to her either, because she gives these teachings to all of us. Everybody here in this room has learned something from her, and we together grow as a community. We help each other as a community, and we answer to each other as a community. We help each other grow. So this understanding part of Zen, this sort of like, what does a Zen person do? Well, they have all these actions that they do, and then they strive to understand things, understand the reality that's around them. And that understanding doesn't just come from a teacher. It doesn't just come from senior students. And as a matter of fact, it doesn't really just come from the people in the Sangha. It comes from everyone around you. And so when you try to think about what is it that I'm supposed to learn, I think more importantly than trying to figure out what is it I'm supposed to learn, you want to maybe think about like, how can I listen right now? How can I be a student of this moment, of the people that are in this room, the people that are in my life? Whether that's a teacher, whether it's a child, whether it's a relative or a friend or Domi, how can I learn from this? Because the teachings are everywhere. I don't know if that made much sense. I feel like maybe that was all of what I had written down to say. And so for the next 15 or 20 minutes, we can just kind of like, I don't know if I can answer any question. If you want to ask a question, that's great. If you want to share some part of your story or practice that maybe resonates, fantastic. But I'll just kind of open it up. And I think in the Dirt Zendo, it's probably small enough. You guys could probably just put your hand up and talk from your seat. I don't think we have to go up to the talkie chair today. Oh, but yeah, Jim does have to unmute you. I think you guys are muted though, Jim. Yes, you are. Yeah, go ahead, Betty.
Thanks, Mick, for the talk. It's very, really good. So a couple of things come to mind. The first one is just a reminder that for myself, my wonderful niece gave me a book called Inside the Grass Hut. It's by Ben Connolly. If anybody's interested in the poem, the poem is written in the front of the book, intact, and then he takes each sort of line or stanza and breaks it down, and it's just really lovely. I don't know if anybody's read it, but it's a great one. I highly recommend it.
I also like a fantastic book, really, really great book. I actually maybe t 2 summers ago, I gave two Tuesday night talks on the grass hut, like in a row on the
Oh
Song of
yeah,
the Grass
cool.
Hut, and I used that book. Such a great book.
Yeah,
I love
it's
that kind
really
of
good.
like deep poetry analysis. I thought it
Yeah.
was, anyways,
You
okay.
could read it multiple times and just keep learning from it. It's really great. So a couple of things come to mind personally for me, and maybe other people can help me with this, but I feel like I practice Zen Buddhism. That's what my spiritual practice is. But I have a hard time and don't call myself a Zen Buddhist. I haven't done Jukai. I just have a hard time calling myself really anything, and kind of always have. And I don't know what that comes from. I don't know if it's just, my own personal resistance to adopting something or naming myself something, or my resistance to joining a religion or whatever. There's probably some baggage back there somewhere. But anyway, so that was one thought. And I thought if anybody can, re if that resonates with anybody, if anybody has any thoughts, solutions for me, that would be great. The other thing too, as you mentioned, like what is the practice of Zen Buddhism? And I think for me, Zazen is really high on the list, and then service to the Sangha and service to the community. That's huge for me. And then living the precepts, which is also important, but not as easy as the other things. And then studying the Dharma and hoping that all those things sort of lead to under greater understanding. So thank you for the talk. Appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, I it's really like fascinating, this notion of like, I don't, I'm gonna guess that a lot of other people have struggled with this, but yeah, like calling myself a Zen Buddhist is something that I'm still a little hesitant to. It's so strange. So here's an interesting thing that I sort of stole from Jinryu, but I was my practice is marked by, it's probably best summed up as like imposter syndrome. I feel like I'm not doing it right. I feel like I'm not really a genuine practitioner and all of this. And this is a very silly practice. If anybody wants to pick it up, I find the sillier the practice, the more effective it is. But I look at myself in the mirror and I say, I am a bodhisattva. And like in the mornings, I'll do it a couple of times, and it's genuinely ridiculous. It's like some Stuart Smalley stuff, but it really has helped me sort of like claim. It's helped me be more comfortable understanding what I know, and it's been also like really helpful sort of spotting it in a lot of other places in my own life. I just in December graduated with a doctorate in mathematics, and I'm still like, I don't know if I wouldn't say I'm an expert, and it's just like, dude, like give it a rest. And I think in a lot of ways, practice, like whatever you want to say about it, either as a religion or as a just like a personal understanding, has really helped me recognize my own behaviors, and not in such a way that I want to forcefully correct them, but I just kind of see them and I'm like, maybe I'm a little unfair to myself. And I think that and just kind of letting it be like that. I don't know. That helps me find sort of like relief from suffering. I don't know. That's great though. That's great. Definitely the like real uncertainty about who I am. One of the I'll tell you this, Chris. Sorry, I know that Linda's got her hand up. I have a lot. If you ask my wife, I have a lot of Dharma tattoos. I have like these, and I have a koi on my shoulder that's new. And one of the really great side effects of this is that like they're there. And so people talk to me about them. And in these conversations, I have to explain to them that I'm a Zen Buddhist, right? Like I have, when I went to Thanksgiving, the first Thanksgiving that I went to with these, my family's like, oh, that's neat. Like, what is it? Talk about it. And it was just sort of this like, I guess I have to talk about how I'm a Zen Buddhist now. And it really kind of like has been a fun side effect of it, is that like I just talk to people about it now. It's just who it's part of. I feel comfortable at least with those pieces. Linda, you've been waiting patiently.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Mick. You introduced your talk as a little bits of tidbits here and there, but you've managed to weave it together beautifully, as
oh, thank
you
you
usually do. So thank you. I'm out walking my dogs, so I apologize if I go out. If you can't hear me, just move on to someone else. And just a quick note to Betty that I think that seems like quite a very Zen Buddhist thing, is to not want to put a label on something, like a very permanent existing concrete thing. I am this. So I'm not giving an answer either, but I think that's quite Zen. I particularly appreciated your talk about renunciation, or your words on renunciation and contrition, and also lineage, and with atonement and contrition. That's so very heartfelt to me, that part. And I love the way you put it, that like atonement is just accepting in like what all your past karma has brought at this present moment. And I work, and most of you may know, I work at a Tibetan Buddhist college. And so, you know, when things happen that seem like an unfortunate event or some, you know, accident or something, there's always somebody who's mentioning, you know, well, you let negative karma burning off. And so it's a chance to just be like, okay, let's appreciate this. This thing is means like, okay, something happened in the past, and now it's like, and not making it like worse, like not making, you know, getting all bent out of shape about it. Just like, okay, that's it. And I had a Tibetan Buddhist practice before I came to Zen. And one of the teachers kind of made us go through, like, think about, it was a class I was taking, and one of the assignments was to go through like all the things you've done in your life, in this life, and kind of actually, so kind of like the 12 step thing where, right, you have to go around and apologize. And it was, and some things were like, well, if you've had an abortion or something, you know, maybe adopt a pet, or I mean, something to kind of like address in your like, if you've stolen something, like make a specific offering of generosity and donation to specifically kind of offset that. And that was kind of an interesting exercise. And I know that's not a very Zen practice, but I do find it interesting. And the point of that was kind of when you sit down, you have a clear mind. To get a clear mind, you can't have all this baggage waiting on you, like, oh, all these terrible things I did. And so kind of the effect was, you know, make that right. And I don't know, it's interesting, all these different ways of doing that. And I feel like I had one more thing, but I forget what that is because I'm out and I didn't take a note. So thank you again very much. I'll leave it up there.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, that notion of like, what do we do about this knot of harmful past karma? And I think, I've adopted a lot of language that I think that earlier me, years ago me, would classify as woo-woo. But like one of the things that I've noticed about a lot of it is that it's really useful. It's really useful language. And I had mentioned like several times, like open-handed. And I think like for me, approaching the past open-handedly without trying to like force yourself to like, because I think like this sort of American puritanical version of contrition or atonement is to like punish yourself. You need to be punished for your past behaviors. And I think that, to approach it open-handed just means understanding it, really and truly understanding it with your mind and your body, and just allowing who you are to produce a world in this moment that can correct for it, right? I don't need to punish myself for what I've done in the past because I have right now. And if I can truly place my past actions into context, that helps me figure out what to do now. I don't need to punish myself for it. I don't need to beat myself up. I just need to understand it and carry that with me right here now. I did have one more wild card thing that I wanted to talk about. I see that I'm almost out of time. So I'm going to do the one more thing, and then maybe we got some time for other people. So there's an old Zen story about Dongshan and Yunyan. And Dongshan and Yunyan studied together. Of course, he left home, right? So he's doing the Zen thing in old times. And he goes to Yunyan, and he's about to leave. And this isn't an exact version of it, but he says later on, so this is the student to the teacher. Later on, if someone asks me if I can depict your reality or your teaching, how shall I reply? Right? And Yunyan kind of pauses and says, just this is it. And that's sort of like the Zen story. And you're like, well, what does that even mean? And more importantly, what does that have to do with this understanding that we're supposed to cultivate? Because like my whole theme, when you read something or you hear something in Zen, like my first instinct is like someone somewhere thought this was important enough to keep all the way up until now. There's got to be something here for me to learn. And so here's this student asking a teacher, like, I'm ready to leave and I'm going to take your teachings and I'm going to go on and I'm going to spread them out. What should I tell them? Right? And Yunyan says, just this is it. And at the moment, they're on a walk, they're together. And I think what it means is that teaching is fundamentally about a relationship. It's about a relationship. Even if you're talking, like, I was a math teacher for 15 years, and you can't teach high school students without having some kind of relationship with them. And if you want to learn something about the essential reality of what we're doing here, having a teacher is about having a relationship with a person and people that are going to teach you. And I think what I would encourage people to do, if you try to feel like, what's the understanding part of my Zen practice? It's important for you to develop a relationship with the people here in the Sangha, chat with them, see how they're doing, find out about them, and let them find out about you. Because the closer your relationship is to people, whether it's Domyo or Jinryu or anybody who comes in, that relationship is the foundation for any teaching or any learning that you'll do. And that is a that like I can tell you from like teaching regular stuff to kids, having a relationship with someone is essential to any kind of learning that you'll do. So I really would recommend, like, try to have a conversation with Domio, try to have a conversation with some senior students. It doesn't have to be about like the meaning of life or existence or anything. It could be about your cat, like, but just like understanding each other is such an important part of learning. And I did want to put that into our learning part of how do you do Zen. We got action and understanding. Okay, does anybody got, we got like 5 more minutes. What's up, Dave?
So as you're going on, I kept going back to something. There's a fellow named Tenshin Roshi who teaches down at Yokoji Mountain Center in Palm Springs. And at the beginning, when someone say, "How's your practice?" I said, "Well, I sat for 20 minutes this morning, and I'm going to sit this time and that." And I heard Tenshin give a talk where he said basically, "Practice is continuous. Practice has no end." And so if you're pissed off, then you're practicing pissed off. If you're drunk, you're practicing drunkenness. And so it's just that, now I think I take a broader view of that word practice. And when you just said, just this is it, this is practice at this moment. And when I leave here to go get gas, I'll be practicing that. And so it's just not something that's can be broken into a discrete period of time. It's from the moment that you're born till the moment you die, right?
Yeah, that's
Yes.
lovely. Thank you. You know, Dave, I was kind of hoping a little bit that you would like disagree with me and that we would like get into some kind of an argument. I was hoping you'd be like, I don't think that's it. We've got maybe like 2 more minutes if anybody wants to jump in with a question or comment. Yeah, Stuart.
Nick, thank you so much for the talk.
You're welcome.
And what came to me out of all of it sort of rushing at me, all the words rushing at me at once, what came back to me was living for the benefit of all people. That if I had to put being a Buddhist in a nutshell, that's what came to me. And what came to me following that is how little I do that. How self-centered my life is. How often do I think about the benefit of other people? I mean, I'm a nice guy. I'm polite to strangers. I give to some charities. But, I do those because they're easy to do. To really put effort into living for the benefit of all people, and really, it shines a light on how much I don't do that. And perhaps it gives me something to think about and to work towards.
Yeah,
That's
thank you. I think that is like so honest, and I think if you polled the room, I think you would find a lot of hands, a lot of people that agree with that sentiment. And I think, yeah, I don't know if it's like a puritanical American thing, but I really struggle with self-generosity. I really struggle to be generous with myself, and for a really long time, I was like, man, you know what? I'll do me first, look at me like taking care of myself, doing all these things for myself. And I think that like it's a really difficult thing. And like to me, that's why that my the notion that I the way I understand contrition has been really helpful for me, because I can just kind of see that. And I can have compassion for all living beings and myself at the same time. And that's a really difficult thing. And the flip side of this coin, it's so interesting. The whole time that I was talking, there's this other flip side, right? Where, yeah, we can learn from the Sangha and all of that. But the flip side of it is that you, everybody here, you are that person. You are part of the teaching. You are part of the Sangha that is providing for other people, right? You are important people to me. You are my Sangha, you, all of you. And that's a really important thing. And the kindness that I want for everybody else, Stuart, that includes you, right? Like, we are all here to be kind, and it kind of includes ourselves. It's kind of hard to cut ourselves out of it. And it's something that I've really found difficult to do. All right, Linda, I'm not going to make you wait anymore.
Sorry, I know we're running out of time, and I just want to thank Stuart for his comments. I totally relate to that. It might be a good practice for those of us who don't feel like we're doing things specifically for other people is to consider and change the intention when we're doing something like standing in line or whatever mundane thing in life, and see how that might be made to benefit other people, like standing in line at the post office, you know, maybe just standing there calmly and being a quiet presence, or I don't know, maybe when you're driving, like, I'm going to be driving very carefully and cautiously to protect all the people and pedestrians on the road. Like, just those little bits of intention can really, I think, be helpful. And yeah, shift our perspective a little bit. That's it. Sorry, I'm really out of breath. I just walked up a big hill. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Well, I think that about brings us to time. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. If you like have questions or want to reach out, feel free to like email me. My email is in the member directory. Like, building Sangha is really important to me. And I don't know, comments, questions, if you think I was silly or whatever, just feel free. I really enjoy hearing. Can we do the closing verse? Sorry, I'm rarely here for Sunday Dharma talks. Okay, I'll do the closing verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mick.
Thanks,
awesome
Mick.
Talk.
That was great.
Thanks, everyone.
Congratulations on your PhD, Mick. Nice
Thank
job.
You. Thanks.
Yay.